Do some significant Jewish-related events this morning of the first and second century. As I told you the last couple of weeks, it is difficult to kind of get started, you know, find our traction in this beginning of church history, because there are so many interrelated things going on at the same time. We know that there was persecution of the Christians, which was causing leadership decisions to be made. We've seen some of that where they decided, you know, we just need to be very strong in our leadership structure in order to keep it from being compromised from within and also without being attacked from the outside. One of the big things that changed, though, during this first and second century period is the Jewish roots of Christianity. The majority of us who are Christians today are Gentiles the world over. And there's a reason for that. I mean, there's more Gentiles in the world than there are Jews, by far. But over the centuries, starting with these first two centuries, the church has lost connection with its Jewishness. And sometimes have been even very aggressively anti-Jewish. And I think we've lost out some of our heritage because of that. We have actually been grafted into Israel. We have become the sons and the daughters of Abraham, who was the prophet of faith. And so I think it's important for us to, when we go through church history, figure out what went sour on that and how we can reverse some of it and make sure that we do have good connection with our Jewish roots. So we begin by just reminding ourselves that Jesus predicted that Jerusalem, the capital city of Judaism for many, many years, for 1,000 years before Jesus, was going to be destroyed because of a prophecy in Daniel, that because they had rejected the Messiah and cut him off, meaning destroyed him, killed him, the city and the temple would also be destroyed. So he made that prediction in 33, and we know it comes to pass within that generation. Now, we also know that in 33, Jesus died, according to Scripture. The Old Testament Scriptures made that very clear. His own personal predictions made it clear that he was going to die for our sins. But that would not be the end of the story. That he would resurrect on the third day, which would be the first day of the week, and that salvation would then be preached through all nations, not just the Jews, but through all nations, because of his sacrifice. Now, Jesus died during Passover or Unleavened Bread Week, and his death and resurrection are both tied in to Jewish feast days. Jesus ascended on the Mount of Olives 10 days before Pentecost, another big Jewish festival day. And before he went, the apostles were actually asking, is this how you're going to establish the kingdom? Because the Old Testament had predicted that there would be something spectacular happening at the Mount of Olives in connection with the coming of the kingdom in the book of Zechariah. And Jesus basically told them, you don't need to know all the details. You don't need to know the times and the dates that the Father's established. You just need to stick around until the promise comes that I told you about already, which would be the Holy Spirit. So the church begins 10 days after that, on Pentecost, at Jerusalem, with the 12 apostles, Matthias being the replacement, the divinely appointed replacement for Judas. And I've got a question for you. What ethnicity was the Messiah, Jesus? He was Jewish. What ethnicity were all 12 apostles? Jewish. What ethnicity were all of those that were immersed into Jesus Christ on the day of Pentecost? Jewish. It is possible that one or two of them might have been proselytes, but they would have counted themselves as being Jewish. The beginning of the church is exceptionally Jewish. It is almost exclusively Jewish. And we have to take that into account for the way that things start, the flavor of it. Now, it's the following year, after he'd been persecuting the church for a little while, that Saul of Tarsus, who is also of what ethnicity? Jewish. He is converted by an appearance of the resurrected Lord on the road to Damascus. It's actually just outside Damascus. And he is told at that time that he was going to become the conduit of taking the gospel to the ethnics, the goyim, the Gentiles within this generation. And he is of great importance to the majority of the church, because the majority of the church does end up being ethnically non-Israeli, Gentiles. And so that's why the Apostle Paul is very prominent in the writings of the New Testament, is because he was dealing with the majority that had come into faith by that time. So you have the growth of the church, and Paul kind of sets the tone for the way that it's done. Everywhere he goes, when he sets up shop, he goes to what worship building in a town? A synagogue, which is for what group? Jews. And that's where he preaches first. He takes the gospel to the Jews of a region first. Once he's saturated that group, once all of them have had the chance to make their choice up one way or the other, either I'm on board with this being the Messiah, or I don't know, or I don't care. Either one of those is the same sort of decision. It's a rejection. Typically, the ones that had rejected it would become very aggressive toward Paul, and they'd kind of run him out of town. And so Paul and his, we'd call them an evangelistic team today, they would make sure that that congregation, that group of believers in that town, had a leadership core. Men who would be the shepherds of that particular group, the elders of that group. What ethnic group do you think more than likely the majority of those guys would be? Jewish, because the odds are they are the majority that grabbed hold of it at the beginning, and they've also got all the background information that they need. So as the church grew, even though it started taking on Gentiles, it still had Judaism or Jewishness at its core. So much so that we have a little problem. You remember the whole Judaizing incident. There were a bunch of Pharisees. They came to the majority Gentile church at Antioch, and they started insisting, all you Gentiles have to become Jewish before you can have Jesus as your Savior. Say that again. Oh, this bunch did. The ones that caused trouble at Antioch did. In fact, they gave the impression that they had been sent from Jerusalem by Jesus' half-brother James. You know how people are sometimes like that. They give the impression that they're talking from a delegation of an authority figure somewhere else. And then you find out later, they weren't sent here by that guy. They're pretending that they were. And that's exactly what happened in Antioch. And that's why we have the whole Acts chapter 15 meeting at Jerusalem. James himself gets up and gives some reasons why these guys went out without authority and they were wrong. And they write a whole letter saying that Gentiles are not expected to become Jewish in order to be saved. They're only expected to act righteously according to the universal principles you find in the book of Genesis, which would be You don't eat arterial blood on purpose. You don't sleep around on your spouse. And you don't worship idols and eat the meat that is being part of that worship service. You basically don't fellowship with pagans in their worship rituals. Now, the not eating things that are strangled, that actually goes with the don't eat meat or don't eat blood thing. And that's the only things that they put on the Gentile believers. Did you hear anything in there about the Sabbath day? Gentiles have to keep the Sabbath day. No. Did you hear anything in there about Gentiles have to keep the feasts? No. Gentiles have to make sacrifices in the temple? No. None of that. And so the clear evidence is, while there was Jewishness to the church was not Judaism. It was not a form of Judaism in that sense, that it is a continuation of Judaism with all its rites and rituals. So as the church grew, you have some of them maintain their Jewishness, their traditions. There is no question, but a lot of Jewish believers continued worshiping on the Sabbath day. They'd been doing it for generations. Why would they quit? There is evidence that the Jewish believers continued circumcising their young people, their young men. But they did not look at it as a means of salvation. So that there was not a problem with that. They kept the feasts and things like that. Some of them even went to the temple when it offered the ability to do so, and they offered ritual sacrifices. But they did not see that as being the way they were saved. They saw it as being kind of still part of the symbolism that was pointing toward Christ. You may remember that Paul came back from one of his missionary journeys, his third, and he arrives at Jerusalem, and James and the other guys who are the leaders of the church there said, "Paul, we've got a problem. There's a lot of people saying that you're teaching that Jews have to become Gentiles to be saved." That's effectively what they told him. "We'd like for you to prove that that's not the case. Here's what they knew. We know you're going to go through your own Nazirite ritual, because Paul clearly took a Nazirite vow every time he went on a trip. And then he cut his hair at the end of the vow when he was on his way back. And then that hair would be offered at the temple, and it would also, there would be some ritual involved, and it would take a week. So they knew that Paul did that on a habit. So they said, "Paul, we have other guys that are going to go through the finishing of their Nazirite vows. Would you just simply join them and even pay for them to go through the procedure?" And what did Paul do? He did it. Now, was he going back on anything that he'd said? No. Because what he'd said was, Gentiles don't have to become Jewish to be saved. But he didn't say Jews have to quit being Jewish in order to be saved. The two are perfectly compatible with one another. And so that's actually the one that the riot took place, because they lied and said that he had Gentiles in the temple inner courtyard with him, and he didn't. Yeah, that would be first, no, not Corinthians, it's Romans. Read the full context. It would be chapters 9 through 11. So, Christianity ends up having some Jewish flavor for some people, but there are other Gentile types that they have really no connection with Judaism, and so they develop their own customs. When you get to this idea of what day of the week do you worship on? What day of the week do we worship on? Sunday, which is the first day of the week. Why do we do that? Because that's the day that Jesus resurrected from the dead. That's what the Gentiles did. Did you know that the Gentile believers didn't get days off? Only the Jewish people had legal protection to take a full day off every week. Only the Jews had a protected day of rest, the Sabbath, under Roman law. So Gentile believers didn't get a day off. So when are they going to worship? They're going to have to worship before the sun comes up, very early in the morning. And guess which day they picked? They picked Sunday morning because, of course, the story about how Jesus resurrected from the dead on the first day of the week before the sun came up. And so they just naturally gravitated toward that. And so that's where we are today. Now, is there anything in Scripture that mandates that you either worship on the Sabbath or worship on Sunday or any other day? Anybody know of a Scripture? I don't know of one. So what we do today, we do by tradition and custom. Now, is there anything wrong with that? No. The problem is, as the writer of Hebrews said, by not gathering together, right? Not gathering together as some were in the habit of doing. That's the problem. Having a regular time of corporate worship and prayer and fellowship and encouragement. And so I just want you to understand here, you've got the church is developing in that first century, but it has a couple of different flavors to it depending on your background. And it's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. No problems. The problem becomes when one group demands that the other do things their way or be lost. Okay? And that's what Paul was always objecting to when he wrote against the Judaizers. Okay, so you know the next big thing that connects into this is what happened in 64. 70% of Rome burned to the ground. And we know probably by the next year, rumors were flying around that Nero, the young emperor, had done this on purpose to try to clear the slums out so that he could build fantastic new buildings for his own honor. And once that rumor got started, it became politically expedient that he find somebody else to blame. And so they blamed the Christians, who had been talking about the world being burned up in flame at the coming of Jesus. And the Christians lived in large numbers in the slums of Rome where the fire started. They were also weird. They met early on Sunday morning before the sun came up, and they ate the body and the blood of their God. And they called each other brother and sister like they were some sort of incestuous family, giving each other kisses and hugs. And so these Romans did not have much of a nudge necessary to believe that the Christians were the arsonists. And so that's where the first Roman persecution of Christians began. It was starting probably right around 65. The book of Hebrews was probably written right around 65 because some Jewish believers in Jesus thought that with the persecution happening, it might be a better idea to pull back into their Judaism and not be counted as Christians because Christians were being, you know, targeted. So I'm just Jewish. And the book of Hebrews is basically, you can't do that. You have to stick with Jesus. Jesus is the point of all the Jewish prophecies. And if you abandon him, you've abandoned them and you're lost. So this is where everything starts picking up big speed then. The next spring in 66, there were riots going on in Jerusalem. Some Jewish rebels were causing trouble. Three different groups, as a matter of fact, and they were fighting with each other. So the Roman 12th Legion came and parked themselves immediately north of the Temple Mount. in order to try to calm this stuff down. Apparently their legate, the guy that was in charge of it, thought just by showing force, by parking themselves there, that would be enough to stop the riots. It didn't. Interestingly enough, though, the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, who were quite well aware of Jesus' prophecy in the Olivet Discourse, when they saw the eagle standard of the legion on Jewish territory, they interpreted that as the abomination of desolation that Jesus had warned them about, and they got out of town. They escaped pretty much to a person and got out of town. So not a single Christian, as far as we can tell, died in the destruction of Rome that happened a few years later. Now, the 12th Legion, their commander, we still don't understand what was motivating him, but he decided at the last second, you know what? I'm not stopping the riot. I'm just getting my guys targeted from overhead sniping points. I'm just going to pull out. And so he tried to pull out of Jerusalem down to the coast, and the Jewish rebels interpreted that as weakness, and they started attacking and ambushing them big time. And it became a rout. They destroyed most of that legion. The legion was so panicked at the end that the commander left a small fighting force to try to cover the retreat. They abandoned all their heavy artillery, and then they all made a run for it to the coast. And very few of them made it. Wiped out the legion. And that is why we know that the next thing that happened was that a whole bunch of Jewish people living at Jerusalem, when they saw that happen, they knew Rome was not going to let that stand. And so they left Jerusalem as well, because they figured that there was going to come reprisals from Rome. It would be right around that same time that Peter was crucified in Rome as a ringleader of the arsonists, as a Jew. Because you see, suddenly these rebel Jews are part of the problem that Rome is having. So he's executed. The rebellion continued into that following year. It's probably in that year that Paul got arrested at Ephesus, and he is also treated as a ringleader. He's taken to Rome, and after a trial that didn't go so well for him, he is beheaded, because he's a Roman citizen, so he has a right to that. But he was condemned by Nero himself. Year three of the rebellion is in 68. Nero gets assassinated in that year, and the military operations that he had commanded against the Judean rebels kind of came to a standstill for a while. Because in the Roman Empire, you've got a whole bunch of groups fighting for who's going to have the next emperor. And it finally settles down in the next year, 69. Where the commander of the Roman forces in the Middle East, he's actually in Egypt at the time, the Roman commander is declared by the armies there, you need to be the next emperor. You have what it takes to sort things out. And so Vespasian leaves the Middle East, and he heads off to Rome, and he leaves in the hands of his son, Titus, the responsibility for finishing the rebellion operations, put down this Jewish rebellion. By then, Titus had pretty much pacified the outlying regions. So he goes to Jerusalem at Passover time of 70 AD, and he sets up a military cordon around the area. No Jews are allowed out. Everybody's trapped. Passover has just started, which means there are well over a million Jewish people in Jerusalem. But they have three fighting factions of Jews inside the city. And they now fight amongst themselves in order to try to gain supremacy. And this is exactly as Jesus predicted it, that love would grow cold and people would have no mercy and pity on one another. And that if these days had not been shortened, no one in Jerusalem would have survived this. When summertime came, now think about that. We're talking only about 3 or 4 months. By the time summer came, the Romans did break through into the city and they did mop-up operations. But by that time, most of the 1.1 million deaths had already occurred. It was Jew-on-Jew violence. And Jerusalem was, it was like a big open tomb. And when they finally tried to storm the last holdout, which was the temple itself, a fire got started, the temple burns, all the gold and silver and bronze melts, and Jerusalem is basically pried up stone by stone, especially the Temple Mount, in order to recover all of those precious metals. Everything that Jesus said happened exactly as he said it would happen. And there's another 100,000 or so Jews that are captured as survivors of that. That's about all that's left. So if you think about 1.3 million people that were probably in Jerusalem when it started, only about 100,000 of them are still alive. And they get taken off into captivity. None of them are Jewish Christians because they're all gone. They took off when the first big crisis happened. Now, this is the big deal here. Without a temple, without the capital city of Jerusalem, which is the city of the eternal king, Judaism shifts its focus. It is no longer focused on temple ritual. They are now focused on personal prayer and reading of the Torah and of good Jewish works. And that is what Judaism is still about today. That's what they shifted to. And the Jews that did survive in the Holy Land developed the habit of going to the ruins of Jerusalem every year in the summer on the 10th day of their fifth month and having a day of mourning over the temple. And that will be allowed for a while. I saw your hand go up. Yep. There were probably quite a few kids. I don't know. In any population, there's at least 20 to 30%, I think, that are under minority or are minority age. You lost it? It'll come back again. When it does, ask it. Okay? But yeah, there would have been a lot of kids that died in it. Okay? In 71, which was counted as year 6 of this Jewish rebellion, Titus went back to Rome because as far as he was concerned, it was pretty much done. They had pacified the place. They'd taken Jerusalem away. They'd taken the temple away. It was just a matter of mopping up, and his guy there could take care of the rest of it. You remembered it? They didn't. There are no more animal sacrifices. That's the point. They felt they had to change their religion from being about rituals on the Temple Mount with the sacrifice of the animals to being what you personally pray to God about and the reading of Scripture on a regular basis out loud. That counts as a sacrifice as far as they were concerned now. And doing good works, which they also said counted as sacrifice. So they basically just changed their religion because they had no place to offer sacrifices anymore. They had a triumphal procession for Titus. And in association with that, the Emperor Vespasian made a declaration that since there is no longer a Jewish temple for the Jewish people to pay their annual temple tax, which would be equivalent of 2 days' wages from every year. So he said, the Jewish people in my empire can now pay those 2 days' wages into the general fund of the Roman Empire, because you're not maintaining your temple. So you can do this as part of your war reparations. See, every time there's a war and it's over with, there's always war reparations. The winning side is supposed to get paid by the losing side. So the temple tax now goes to Rome for every practicing Jew. Now, I've put a little note here. It is at this point that at least some, perhaps many, Jewish Christians ceased Jewish practices. Because what would be the point? They can't send their temple tax, you know, customarily down to Jerusalem because there's no temple there. So why keep that up? And why would you want to send it off to Rome? It's just better to go, well, I'm not a practicing Jew, I'm a Christian. So you see now the beginning of the pulling away of Judaism and Christianity from one another. Okay? In 73, they finally finished the mop-up operations with the Masada, taking of Masada, which was the last holdout position. During the 80s and the 90s, there was a second Roman persecution of Christianity that took place under Emperor Vespasian. Vespasian decided we need to have a more traditional Roman religion in my empire. And so those like the Jews and the Christians who practiced otherwise became kind of not very well liked. And Christians in particular, since Nero had already kind of started this idea that they're a bunch of nonconformists, a bunch of arsonists that don't want to be part of the empire, they became the major target. In the 90s, Vespasian made sure that this temple tax was aggressively collected. I mean, they would go door to door with Jewish communities and collect it. It was at this time that Clement of Rome wrote that letter to the Corinthians we talked about. And in that letter, he's already talking about how you need to kind of pull tight and follow your leader, because we got all these problems going on. John wrote the book of Revelation from Jesus right around this time. And you can even feel in it some of the tension between the Jews and the Christians in some of the letters at the beginning. In 96, you got a new emperor. Emperor Nerva decided he didn't want them to do the aggressive collection of the Jewish temple tax anymore, but he was only on the throne for 2 years. So 98, Emperor Trajan, he comes into power. He is definitely very much invested in this idea of the traditional Roman religions and the worship of his dead father, Emperor Vespasian, and his dead older brother, Emperor Titus. They are now counted amongst the deified gods, and so he wants everybody to pay special homage to them. Christians cannot do that. They do not count people as gods, and so they become targeted. It's in 108 that Bishop put that in quotes again. Bishop Ignatius, we talked about him, he surrendered himself to Trajan at Antioch. Basically said, I'm the leader of the Christians in this community. What are you going to do about it? And so he gets arrested, and he's sent off to Rome to be executed by wild beast, which tells us that he was probably not a Roman citizen. And he writes 7 letters, which we went over last week. Those letters are very much this idea, you have to listen to what your bishop says. Your bishop makes the rules. And if you don't follow his lead, you are not legitimate. And so they become more and more, you know, pulling in tight, you know, to this idea of we've got to be authoritative in our own community to survive. He's also the one that says we can't let Judaism be a part of Christianity. Judaism cannot be forced on Gentiles. Now, that's perfectly accurate. But think about the tone of the time. You know, Jews are losing more and more, they've lost most of their favor within the Roman Empire, and so the Christian Gentiles are wanting to not have any connection with them, especially after what happens next. I've got a note there that Bishop Polycarp of Smyrna writes his little letter. He says something similar about the bishops in his letter. In 112, we talked about this, Trajan, the emperor, answers a request from Pliny of Bithynia, saying, am I supposed to track Christians down? Can I take anonymous tips? And Trajan's response was, no, that would not be appropriate to take anonymous tips, and you don't need to track them down. If you find out somebody's a Christian, then yes, prosecute them according to the law. Let them go if they prove that they're not a Christian anymore, and execute them if they are, regardless of their age or gender. And so the persecutions were clearly still going on at that time. In 113, so the following year, Trajan decides that he's going to go into Parthia, which is the traditional enemy of the Roman Empire at this time. It's Persia, basically. Iraq, Iran. And he's going to prosecute a war against them and just put down this border problem once and for all. He is barely out on his operations there when this happens. In 115 to 117, you've got Jews in northern Africa, in Cyrene, who start a second Jewish rebellion. And they are soon joined by Jews in Egypt, particularly in the capital city of Alexandria, which had the largest Jewish population outside of Jerusalem. Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, and in Judea itself. And they went around killing anyone who was not Jewish. They went on a rampage. Starting in northern Africa, they killed almost 250,000 people, civilians. We're not talking about them fighting military battles against the Roman military. We're talking they went on rampages and killed civilians just because they weren't Jewish. And it spread to these other places, and when it was all done, 500,000 Gentiles had been killed by rampaging ethnic Israelis. Now, how do you think that went over? It did not go over at all. Trajan gave up on his Parthian campaign, partly because of this problem. I mean, he's got issues behind him in his own empire. And so he returns to Italy, where he's probably planning on trying to, you know, take this stuff into hand, but he dies there very quickly. He had suffered apparently very greatly physically while he was on his campaigns. His replacement was the legate of Syria named Hadrian. He had adopted Hadrian as an older son. And he becomes the new emperor. And Hadrian is the one that finished putting down the second Jewish rebellion there in the Middle East. And then he goes and starts dealing with some problems up on the northeastern border of Rome. Right, well, it was kind of family connected by now, and that's why Hadrian gets to become the new emperor, even though he's not related by blood to the previous guy. The previous guy adopted him as an adult and said, this is my son. You now have to accept him as the next guy. It's kind of a family dynasty that's being passed down. And so that's how they did it. So Hadrian, he puts down the Jewish rebellion hard. Now, but he loses an awful lot of Roman troops in it. A lot. There's a couple of legions that have to be reconstituted after this. Now again, how do you think that made the Roman government feel toward Jews? They were not in good graces anymore. Now this is really weird, and it is in high contrast to a century before. Just a little over a century before, King Herod of the Jews was the third most powerful person in the Roman Empire. He was the close friend and confidant of the emperor. And Roman law protected Jews as a special class. And suddenly now that has all been flipped on its head. And I would suggest to you that it has everything to do with the judgment coming upon the rebellious Jews who would not accept Jesus as their Messiah. Because that was what the prophecy said would happen, is that they would come under the judgment of God for refusing his son. What's that? They were in good connection with the Romans to begin with, but then they rejected Jesus and everything went... Oh, the Jews? Yeah, for a while. For about 2 years, until the Romans really got their act together and got their legions back into their places, and then they lost. Okay, so all of that brings me to the second little bold note I put in here. Even more Jewish Christians broke off their ethnic ties to their ethnic heritage at this point. So, if you are a Jew by ethnicity, but you have been a practicing Christian for several generations now in your family, and Jews are now definitely on the outs with the Roman culture, why would you want to continue your connections to Judaism? You wouldn't. Because, I mean, you're not practicing Judaism. You're practicing Christianity. So you have many of these guys actually take different names. They become much more Gentile, because they would rather be thought of as Christians and be persecuted for Jesus Christ than to be treated as if they were the hated Jews. Okay? So again, you've got Christianity kind of drawing farther and farther away from their Jewish roots. 122 to 133, we know that Hadrian made this tour around his empire. He we'll give him credit for this. He was an administrator. He believed, I need to know where all the problems are, the bottlenecks. I need to know where we need to fix stuff. So he personally went all over the empire and evaluated things and made programs based on what he saw. Now here's an interesting point. In 130, he was definitely in Judea. And he stopped at the ruins of Jerusalem. And he made a decision then and there, based on all the information that he'd been given, I'm going to build a Roman city on the ruins of Jerusalem. And it is going to have in it a temple to Jupiter, the king of the gods. And he was going to give a name to this city, Aelia Capitolina. Aelia was his family name. The Romans have a whole bunch of different names, and one of his names was Aelius. And so Aelian is going to be his family connection to this city, this Roman city. Capitolina is named after the Roman city of Rome, temple to Jupiter. Jupiter's temple at Rome was called Capitolina. And so he's going to basically make Jerusalem's ruins into kind of like a little Rome with its own little temple to Jupiter. Now, how do you think that went over with the Jewish people? It made them feel suddenly like the Maccabee story. Because when the Greeks came to Jerusalem under Antiochus IV and took the city over, they built an altar to guess which god? Zeus, which is equivalent to Jupiter. So this feels to them, this is a flashback. It's all happening again. The temple of God is being turned into the temple of Zeus, Jupiter. And so you've got a guy by the name of Simon Bar-Kosba. Bar means son. So Simon, the son of Kosba, and he took the lead in starting a third Jewish rebellion. He started it at the city of Modin in Judea. Now the reason that's significant is because that's where the Maccabeans started their revolt. So he's basically trying to repeat their the Maccabean success story. Big difference though. Simon starts styling himself as the Prince of Israel. But we have some of the correspondence that took place during his, quote, reign. And he was an absolute tyrant. He threatened people with death over some of the smallest infractions. And he does not seem to have any type of real faith. He seems to be a guy that just saw a chance to be in charge and to start a rebellion against Rome so that, you know, he could have his own little kingdom in the Middle East. Later Jews are kind of split about their characteristics of him. Some of them think he was a freedom fighter. Others think he was a horrible false messiah. I think he's a horrible false messiah. One of the rabbis at the time started referring to him as Bar Kokhba, which is very close pronunciation of his given name, Bar-Kosba. Bar-Kokhba means son of the star. And so this rabbi was trying to say, this is the guy that's fulfilling the Old Testament prophecy about a star rising up in Israel, being the Messiah. And of course, he's not the Messiah. The Messiah has already come and was rejected, which is why Jerusalem is in ruins and there is no temple and all this trouble is happening. But this guy, here's something else he did. Simon Bar Kokhba threatened any Jewish Christians living in his region. If you do not join my army as a good Jew, I will kill you. And so he is not looked at very favorably in church history. He is a persecutor, a Jewish persecutor of the church, of the Jewish people that were still living in Judea. And he didn't survive, though, because Hadrian started some military operations against him in 134. It went on for the next 3 years. Hadrian was not going to take any chances. He put together 6 reinforced Roman legions. A reinforced legion is one that's got elements from another legion. So he basically took 6 full legions and then took components from 6 others and jammed them into these legions. And we're talking about well over 100,000 veteran Roman soldiers. And they came to Judea and they had no pity. Now, the Jewish people fought back hard, too. Simon's soldiers had no pity on anybody either. So there were a lot of Romans that died, but there were a whole lot more Jews that died. More than 500,000 Jews died in this military operation. Now, I want you to think about the numbers we're talking about here. We know 1.1 million died in 70. We know an undetermined amount died during the wars that happened in North Africa and Judea and all that stuff at the beginning of the century. And now we've got another 500,000. We are probably talking about a couple million plus Jewish people dead within about 50 years. Okay? And it wasn't just that. They burned, destroyed completely, 1,000 Jewish cities throughout Judea. And anyone of Jewish extraction was barred from visiting the new city of Aelia Capitolina at any time. They were basically told, I don't care if you want to come here and mourn over the destruction of Jerusalem back in 70. If you set foot in the precincts around Jerusalem, you will be executed. Now, that rule was only relaxed once Constantine became emperor, and he felt that the Jewish people had been treated overly harshly by his predecessors. And so he relaxed that rule to allow them to come to the Jerusalem city of Aelia Capitolina once a year on the 10th day of their fifth month. The Roman province of Judea ceased being called by that name at this time. Instead, the Roman designation was now Syria Palestina. Does that sound familiar? Palestine. That is how the name Palestine got attached to the Middle East, the holy city, or the holy land, is because Hadrian was so angry and frustrated with everything that had been going on with the Jews over the last 50 years that he said, enough is enough. We are going to stop Judaism from being attached to the Middle East, from being attached to the ruins of Jerusalem, or now known as Aelia Capitolina. And pretty much the break between Christianity and Judaism was complete by this time. Christians did not think of themselves as Jewish, even if they had Jewish ethnicity. They thought of themselves as Christians. And they acted as Christians. They didn't do Jewish rituals. There were very few, what we call today, messianic congregations. They were an extreme minority. And that is the background out of which we go to the next section of our church history study, which is where you will have people start saying to Christians, you can't do anything that connects you with Judaism or we will punish you, including calendar issues. And so the Jewish heritage of Christianity was pretty much shoved into the deep, dark crevices of Christianity at that time. And it will not be recovered until later, which I think is really, really sad. Because they missed out on a lot of the symbolism by not studying the Old Testament. A lot of the Christians didn't bother to study the Old Testament anymore after this because it was Jewish. Say that again. What about the Seventh-day Adventists? Well, they do, but they do their own little spin on it. Right, they're interested in the New Testament, but they will keep the Sabbath practices from the old. Yep. Yeah, it's really kind of sad. There's actually a history and restoration movement where you had some restoration preachers that had a bad attitude toward the Old Testament. They said, we're New Testament believers. There's no room for the Old Testament here. Excuse me? You understand that the Old Testament is the background for the New Testament, right? You won't understand the New Testament unless you understand the Old Testament. No, we're New Testament believers. Okay. It becomes very frustrating to see that sort of attitude. So, comments, questions, real quick. That is why there is, in many sections of Europe and Africa and the Middle East, anti-Semitism, is because of a lot of the history that preceded this. Yep. And it got ingrained in some components of the church. And it shouldn't have. And we're going to do our best to combat it. Okay? We are not supposed to be Jewish believers in the sense that we keep the Old Testament law, but we better understand that it's part of our heritage. Yes, they have that same sort of attitude, is that we can kind of make up our own rules about how we relate to God. And as long as I do good stuff, God has to treat me nice. Well, it's nice you feel that way, but there's no God component in there. God's not the one that said that that's what counts. So, yeah, it becomes a problem when we start making up our own rules how God has to treat us. Right? Wouldn't it be nice? That's right. I'm a good person, so God has to let me into heaven. No, he doesn't. You can't boss God around. You need to come on his terms. And I find myself reminding Christians of that often, because they bought into, you know, the foolishness being taught in a lot of circles that, well, God just wants us to be happy, and we can do stuff and he'll be fine with that. He'll let it slide. What Bible have you been reading? God has got some very specific things he expects from us. And we need to come on his terms, not our make-believe terms. Okay, we'll pray. Father, thank you for church history and for the reminder we get from